From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Pittsburgh Pirates have a sparkling state-of-the-art stadium, and they've promised fans they'll soon have a competitive team. So why do so many Pittsburghers want to keelhaul Pirates management? Ahead on Only a Game, near mutiny in the Steel City. Also a college football preview, and why the Big Tuna's decision to swim with dolphins should net Miami's owners an extra $300 million. Also ahead, a closely knit group ventures out to Dodger Stadium to hear the crack of the bat and the click-clack of the knitting needles.
I'm finishing my sleeves and my sweater because there's not a whole lot going on the field, so I've been able to focus on that, so that's a positive thing.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Throughout the land today, marching bands will march, cheerleaders will cheer, and face painters will paint their faces, and some of them won't stop there. That's because the college football season is underway, and joining me now for a preview is SI.com senior writer Stuart Mandel. Stuart, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Florida Gators are the defending national champions. They have the 2007 Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow back, and they are ranked number one coming into this season as well. Will the Gators repeat?
They're certainly the heaviest favorites to do so that I've seen in a while. It's very rare in this day and age for a team to win the national championship and bring back all 11 starters on defense. There were a couple guys that definitely could have turned pro and did not. And then you couple that, like you said, with a former Heisman-winning quarterback who many feel is one of the best to play ever to play the game. It's a great combination, you know. Anything can happen in this sport. They, even last year in winning the title, lost a game nobody thought they would to Ole Miss. But on paper, I certainly think they're the team to beat.
The 2008 Heisman winner was Oklahoma's Sam Bradford. He, too, is returning for another season. The Sooners are ranked number three heading into this campaign. They open at BYU. How far will Bradford take the Sooners this year?
Well, it's a really interesting and historic year this season. Not only is he back, but also Colt McCoy from Texas. So that means the top three Heisman vote-getters from last year are all back for the first time. I think Bradford, it's going to be a little bit different team for him this year. They're not going to have to rely on him to pass quite as often. He also is going to be playing behind some young offensive linemen. I think he'll do quite well, but I see, with Texas and Oklahoma being in the same division and playing each other, I just like Texas a little bit better than Oklahoma this year.
We've talked about Tebow, Bradford, and McCoy. Are quarterbacks the only guys passing up a shot at the NFL for another year in college?
No, I mean, this was a very unusual offseason, not just the quarterbacks, but in general, even on Oklahoma's team alone, on their offense, they have three or four possible first-round picks who all came back for their senior year. USC has a safety, Taylor Mays, who is arguably one of the two best defensive players in the country, shocked everybody when he came back to school. So for people who follow the college game more than the NFL, it was really refreshing when all these announcements came down last January.
Well, what has happened? Have all these football schools just hired especially fascinating professors so these guys can't stand to leave the campus?
As much as I'd like to think that's the case, not so much, I think some of the players are starting to see that the NFL, they like to call it the no-fun league for a reason. Somebody like Taylor Mays, who I've spent some time with, is just a really good, fun-loving kid. His family is not destitute. He's not desperate to get out there and start making money. He'd rather spend another year being a college kid.
Thursday, number 14 Boise State hosted number 16 Oregon in what was supposed to be the highlight of college football's opening night, but the game was overshadowed by the post-game actions of Oregon's tailback LeGarrette Blount. First, Blount punched a Boise State player who apparently said something to him after the game, and then he went berserk, fighting his own teammates. He refused to leave the field. I'm guessing this isn't the kind of press the NCAA was hoping for in week one.
It was extremely unfortunate. I was in attendance, and you're right. The atmosphere going into the game was pretty electric. The Boise State fans were excited, national TV audience. The game wasn't that exciting, but it was at least uneventful until the very end. And, the really unfortunate part is that this week the Coaches Association had a sportsmanship initiative where all around the country this weekend, players from the opposing teams are going to have a pregame handshake, like they're in Little League. And Oregon and Boise State did that, and LeGarrette Blount was one of the players who took part in it. And then after the game, you know, one of the worst displays of sportsmanship personally I've ever seen.
This afternoon, the Minnesota Golden Gophers visit Syracuse. The once proud Orange have a new starting quarterback in Greg Paulus, late of the Duke basketball team. Many players changed positions during their careers, but last I checked, point guard was not a position in football. Will the Paulus experiment be a success?
You know, he hasn't played since high school, so I don't know what kind of player he's going to be. I do know that Syracuse's program, which has a great tradition and history, obviously, going back to Jim Brown and all the great players that have played there, has been really in the dumps for about 5 or 6 years now. They brought in a new coach, and I think Greg Paulus, whether they even win more games this year, he'll bring a little bit of excitement to the program. He was one of the top high school quarterbacks in the country, but that was in 2004, and he chose to play basketball for Duke instead. The thing about his Duke career is that he became a kind of legendary for players dunking on him. A lot of YouTube clips of players dunking on him. So the equivalent in football would be if he just gets sacked over and over and over again, which is entirely possible on Syracuse. So for his sake, I hope he doesn't end up on YouTube for the wrong reasons as much.
Tell us about some of the other schools that we haven't discussed from which you are expecting big things this year.
The Ole Miss Rebels, who haven't won an SEC title since 1963 when Archie Manning was there, are starting very high in the polls and with good reason. They, like I said earlier, they were the one team to beat Florida last year. They beat Texas Tech in the Cotton Bowl. I look at them as Florida's main threat in the SEC. Illinois could be a surprise team in the Big Ten. I don't think they're by any means a national title team, but you know, everybody kind of expects Ohio State and Penn State to steamroll through that conference like they have the past few years. I think Illinois might sneak up and have something to say about that. And then a little, you know, more off the radar, maybe every year you have a BCS buster. BYU plays Oklahoma tonight. I don't know if they're going to beat Oklahoma, but they have a tough enough schedule the rest of the way that it's not inconceivable they can make the BCS with one loss.
Stuart Mandel writes about college football and basketball as a senior writer for SI.com. Stuart, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Pirates of Pittsburgh currently sail the stormy seas of the National League's next-to-lowest latitude. Their fans have grown tired of the team's annual self-scuttling and consider the contribution of 143 million gold taxpayer doubloons to the park's treasure chest as high seas swindle, even though it's located on the banks of the Allegheny River. Michael Bartley of WQED in Pittsburgh has the story.
It's arguably the best, and here in Pittsburgh, diehard fans will tell you it is the best major league stadium in the country. PNC Park on the north shore of the Allegheny River, across from busy downtown Pittsburgh, where fans sip Iron City beer to chase down Primanti sandwiches, the ones topped with French fries and coleslaw. And there's no bad seat in this house. But tonight against the Brewers, it's almost an empty house. Frustrated Pittsburgh fans, fresh from Super Bowl and Stanley Cup victories, lament yet another losing, stuck in the cellar Pirates season. 17 consecutive years of losing. Fans like Lena Miles of suburban Pittsburgh come to first-class PNC Park begrudgingly.
It's hard to be a devoted fan.
But yet you're here at PNC Park tonight.
On a freebie.
Oh, otherwise you wouldn't come?
Probably not.
And that's a subtle assessment compared to that of Bob Apel of suburban Monroeville, PA. He came for a high school reunion, not to cheer on the Pirates.
It's hard. You get to watch the Penguins and the Steelers. You know, you expect certain things in Pittsburgh, and this is not what you expect.
Do you think the Pirates are selling out the fans?
Yeah, I think they're here just to make sure that they make money. They drop everybody. They get rid of people.
They got rid of popular and productive players Freddie Sanchez, Jack Wilson, Adam LaRoche, Niger Morgan this summer. Last year, it was Jason Bay and Xavier Nady.
Disappointing at best. You try to understand it, but after 17 seasons, you've kind of almost lost hope.
The Pirates' master plan, as some call it, has a simple rebuilding strategy. It goes like this: deal veterans for prospects. In the press box, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Dejan Kovacevic, who's covered the Pirates day-to-day for 5 years, calls this master plan ambitious and possibly unrealistic.
The Pirates have looked at models around Major League Baseball. They've seen the Cleveland Indians, Minnesota Twins, Tampa Bay Rays as building from the ground up, and at the obvious forfeiture of the Major League product, and that's something that's not being well received in Pittsburgh, as I'm sure you've seen and heard. People don't like to see their favorite players, productive players, popular players, traded away. The Pirates have done that with just about everybody at this point. There's not too many left.
And do they ever know it? Pirates team president Frank Coonley defends the annual rebuilding, yet understands why fans are so critical, tired of losing.
The standards in Pittsburgh are quite high, and that's in part because the teams in Pittsburgh have been so successful. So the success of those teams, the Steelers and the Penguins, has raised the expectation levels of our fans, and that's understandable, and we accept it. In fact, we accept the challenge and are looking forward to meeting that challenge.
Coonley and GM Neil Huntington came aboard 2 years ago to lead Pirates fans out of their misery. Coonley asked for patience, saying when they got here, the team's minor league system was the worst in baseball, with no core players coming up. A recipe for disaster, he says. So the master plan is an overhaul of the entire system. Coonley rejects a quick-fix approach to winning and reminds Pirates fans of the We Are Family World Series championship years of the 70s when the team's minor league ranks were one of the best of the majors.
When a player left the Pirates, there was always someone to replace him in, through the minor league system. That's what we're doing here. Spending simply to mollify a fan base that's frustrated is something that has hurt this organization in the past.
In a loyal sports city like Pittsburgh, Coonley and Pirates management know that if their trade veterans for prospects master plan doesn't work in 2 years, they'll be judged even more harshly, perhaps run out of town, and Coonley knows it.
We certainly love our fans, and we appreciate the frustration that they must feel. It is because we love our fans that we need to do things the right way. So we can't simply patch this up. Let's try to keep a couple of the players who are popular in town. We need it to build a winner.
If it works, though, Coonley becomes heroic. Mentioned with the names Rooney and Lemieux, and some fans do like the deal, including 29-year-old R.J. Schoenfeldt of Pittsburgh.
I like the fact that they're trading for a lot of pitchers. It seems like they're playing the numbers game, so the more pitchers we can get into the system, the better chance we have of having a good rotation and at least contend to have a .500 record or better. You know, I think the hitting will always be there.
So what are you expecting in the next couple years?
I think we're probably like a good couple years away. I'm hoping that our pitching comes around and we can just get some more consistent hitting, and that's the thing. So I have faith in them. I can't explain why.
For Only a Game, I'm Michael Bartley in Pittsburgh.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Barry Micklethwaite, who has won 50 trophies in 20 years for growing onions as big as volleyballs and monstrous parsnips as well, has been banned from some of England's vegetable-growing competitions. Mr. Micklethwaite maintains that the ban is a result of sour grapes on the part of the organizers of the competitions, who are tired of seeing him win so often. Said organizers have contended that Mr. Micklethwaite behaves badly on the rare occasions when his giant vegetables do not prevail. Mr. Micklethwaite has vowed to take the South Yorkshire District of the National Vegetable Society to court, which leads one to wonder how they'll like them apples. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with former NFL player Michael Oriard about his new old book, The End of Autumn. But first, a story in the current issue of Forbes magazine contends that Bill Parcells, who has been the head coach of several NFL teams and is presently the vice president of football operations for the Miami Dolphins, has added about $300 million to the value of each franchise that has employed him. Joining me now to explore that intriguing proposition and whether that magic will also envelop Miami is Jeff Darlington, who writes about the Dolphins for the Miami Herald. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Parcells certainly has earned a reputation for being able to rapidly improve the performances of previously unimpressive teams. He did it in New York, in New England, and he did it in Dallas. What has he done in his first full year with the Miami Dolphins?
Well, you know, when he first arrived during his initial press conference, Bill Parcells said that he was charged with the task of changing the culture in Miami, and that's exactly what he's done to this point. He brought in a head coach, Tony Sperano, and a general manager, Jeff Ireland, both of whom really follow his philosophies in really pushing players and squeezing them for everything that they can provide, and that's exactly what's happened in Miami in 1 year. People feel that they have more of a responsibility to provide the kind of effort that Bill Parcells calls upon them, and the culmination of that has caused more success on the football field.
Does the idea that Mr. Parcells increases the value of a franchise by $300 million by signing on seem likely to you?
Well, it seems likely in a lot of ways. First of all, Bill Parcells at this point in his career now adds a level of intrigue just by his arrival alone. You know, I think that as soon as I talk to players when Bill Parcells arrived, they tuck in their shirts a little bit tighter, they stand a little bit straighter, and everybody knows when Bill Parcells walks in the room that you better be a complete professional. And in any business, if you have a CEO who commands that kind of respect, it's going to increase the value of that company because the performance level is going to be raised.
Well, tucked in shirts and standing up straight is all well and good, but what do the players say specifically about how Parcells does what he does?
That's the thing. Parcells in Miami is not even a coach at this point. It's not like he's going around teaching these guys how to be good players. He's just holding them accountable, and he wants tough players, disciplined players, and smart players. And it's the fact that Bill Parcells knows talent, whether it's front office talent or talent on the football field. And there's no doubt in my mind that Bill Parcells is the best evaluator of talent that this generation has seen.
Tony Sperano, the head coach, is the guy who's striding up and down the sidelines, and he's the guy at the press conferences who has to answer questions when the game is over. Fans don't see Bill Parcells on a day-to-day basis, but do they give him credit for what's going right with the team?
Well, I think that people are starting to finally realize that Tony Sperano does deserve a lot of that credit, and I think that Bill Parcells should be credited for finding the right people to get it done and instill his message, and I think that Tony Sperano and Jeff Ireland should be credited for actually executing. And the players do believe that Tony Sperano is their guy. He's their coach. And Bill Parcells is a guy that kind of oversees the organization, while Tony Sperano is a guy that oversees the actual team.
While Bill Parcells was the head coach here with the New England Patriots, it was football, football, and more football. He never talked about anything else. Is that the way he is and now that he perhaps has mellowed in Miami?
You know, it's unfortunate. He doesn't talk at all down here. Does not meet with the media. He's met with the media twice since he was hired. Now, I can tell you that the other people that talk to him and guests of his that show up at camp, all they talk about is baseball, horse betting, and boxing. So it's never about football with those guys. It's always the guy watches every single Marlins baseball game, and if you show up and want to talk baseball, he will have your ear for hours.
You have written recently that nobody ever knows how long Bill Parcells will remain with a given team. Obviously, that applies to his present position as well. To what extent does the Parcells magic continue to prevail after he retires, which, I would point out, he may lead the league in retiring?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm intrigued by that because when you look at Dallas, Parcells, when he left Dallas, he took a lot of his people with him. And as a result, I think that they have suffered a little bit of a hangover because of that. I really don't think that Dallas is the same team they were when Parcells was there. I think that they're a skeleton of that team. And as I think that's the reason that you haven't seen them quite succeed to the level that they did when Parcells was there. And you know, in Miami, Parcells seems to really be grooming Tony Sperano and Jeff Ireland to stay for a long time. I think that that's the biggest difference between what Miami will deal with when Parcells, you know, departs and what Dallas is going through now.
Maybe this is a dumb question given the presence of Mr. Parcells in Miami, but how good will the Dolphins be this season?
That's a very good question. Obviously, part of their success last year was the result of a schedule that was pretty friendly in the sense that a lot of West Coast teams traveled to the East Coast. The Dolphins had to play the Bills in a dome in Toronto as opposed to the balmy conditions of Buffalo. There was a lot of things that went right, including the fact that they really only suffered three major injuries. And, you know, people can say that that's good luck and good fortune, or you can say that Parcells' off-season program actually causes players to stay healthier longer. So it's really a matter of what you want to believe. If you want to believe that it's a matter of good fortune, then the Dolphins could fall off considerably this year. If you want to believe that it's a part of the culture, then the Dolphins could continue to charge ahead. But make no mistake, they've got a really difficult schedule ahead of them, and for them to not regress is going to be a huge task.
Jeff Darlington writes about the Dolphins for the Miami Herald. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
In 1973, Mike Oriard played the last of his 42 games at center with the Kansas City Chiefs. He played a few more games in the Canadian Football League before retiring from pro football. 8 years later, having completed his Ph.D. in English at Stanford, Dr. Oriard produced a book about his football experiences. Now, The End of Autumn, Reflections on My Life in Football is back in print. The author joins me from Oregon State University, where he is a professor of English. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's very nice to be with you.
You write about how, as a child, you saw football players as heroes, and you modeled yourself on them. At one point, you wrote, "We all need heroes." Do you think football players still fulfill that function for small boys?
You know, that's a really hard one. I mean, I think small boys today are so much more aware of football players through, you know, a 24/7 media sports culture that makes them celebrities rather than heroes. Heroes are famous for what they've done, and celebrities are famous for who they are. and you know, my guess is that in some way, because more of my sense of these guys had to be imagined, they took on heroic dimensions for that reason, if no other. Whereas today, I mean, kids know so much about these guys on and off the field. And, you know, I don't know exactly how it differs for them and their experience differs, but it seems to me it is different.
You write about how important it was for you to leave pro football on your own terms rather than at the whim of a coach. Why was that so significant?
Football was a chief way through which I worked out, you know, all the ordinary, normal travails of adolescence and youth and so on. I was always a good student. I was fortunate in growing up in a stable, middle-class home. I walked on at Notre Dame and then had almost a kind of fairy tale experience. I was going to graduate school after college, but football was a kind of happy accident that kept happening. And so, you know, I played parts of 5 more years, and I was cut by the Chiefs at the end of the players' strike in 1974 summer camp. And so when an opportunity to finish out the season in Canada came up, I jumped on it and then went back to Stanford and finished my dissertation and got on with my life. But, you know, that closure in Canada with the Hamilton Tiger Cats probably made me a little bit less haunted by what ifs or what could have beens, that sort of thing.
Most observers would probably say that television has made the National Football League the mighty colossus that it has become. But you wrote back in 1981 that, quote, "the television camera has become an incredibly obtrusive part of any football game." Were you arguing that TV had diminished the appeal of pro football?
You know, when I played, when I sensed a television camera pointed at me, I very consciously looked away, you know, not to acknowledge my awareness of this camera there. There was some sense in which a television camera or being on television interfered with the serious crusading business of trying to beat those SOBs across the field sort of thing, right? And, you know, with television's ubiquity and, you know, the presence of more and more cameras on sidelines and, you know, players beginning to not ignore the camera, but turn and face him, and hi, Mom, and we're number one, and then all the other stuff that followed. I mean, it's weird to have made that comment in 1981, absolutely unaware of what would follow. You know, this was before SportsCenter took off and all of that sort of thing.
In the years since you have retired, we've learned a great deal about how some football players have been damaged by their work. Most recently, there have been several stories, some reported on this program, about players who've suffered permanent brain damage as a result of multiple concussions. That evidence has come in autopsies. Has that changed your attitude toward the game at all?
I was never caught up in all of the illusions of the game. I consider myself a real beneficiary. You know, the game was good to me, and in part it was an accident of the time, and in part it was an accident of my own experiences. Today I have, you know, some major spinal issues, not had surgeries yet, but I'm working really hard at managing my spine through exercise and diet and all that sort of thing. I guess it's through our children, our own children, where, you know, we sort of have to come to terms with what we value. And my younger son played football in high school well enough to be courted by some local D3 teams, but he wasn't big enough to be courted by D1 teams. Mm-hmm. He wanted to major in construction management. And in this area, that meant either Oregon State or University of Washington. And he wanted to go away to school, and I didn't want him to go to school where his old man was a professor. So he went to the University of Washington for construction management, which meant he couldn't play football. He wasn't going to be able to even walk on. When that happened, his mother and I looked at each other, and we smiled, and we said, yes, you know, because our son Alan had had a concussion each season since the seventh grade. He was susceptible to concussions, and we know what these things mean. You know, it wasn't like when I played, oh, you got your bell rung, shake it off and get back in there. And so the fact that we weren't going to have to worry about our son playing college football was an enormous relief to us.
One of the themes that runs through the end of Autumn involves the difficulty players have separating themselves from the game, and we've talked a little bit about that already. But your contention seems to be that players who, quote, care too much about football find that especially difficult. What led you to feel that way?
Well, I mean, in part it was, you know, thinking about myself in the locker room with my teammates in Kansas City. And I was going to graduate school at Stanford in the off season, and you know, I could tell that a lot of them envied the fact that, you know, when I was done playing, whenever that would be, I had this real life to move on to. And if your sense of yourself is, you know, I'm somebody who plays football, but I also, you know, have these interests and I also do that and I'm good at this and so on, then it's just not going to matter. And this is where I think one of the changes has happened since I played. You know, in those days, you know, you played whatever sport you were good enough to play in season, you know, as long as you were good enough to play it and still enjoyed playing it. And then if you were good enough, you know, you just kind of kept playing at the next level. Today, you know, you don't just play football in season. You know, you go to camps in the summer and you lift weights in the off season and all of that sort of thing, even when you're kids. You know, and it's worse in basketball and soccer. But that kind of wholesale commitment to the sport is probably necessary to get to the levels at which I play. And, you know, having made that much greater commitment than I had to make, leaving it behind has to be that much more difficult. It you know, it just stands to reason that that would be the case.
Michael Oriard, a veteran of 4 years in the National Football League, is now a professor of English and the associate dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Oregon State University, and he joined me from the campus in Corvallis. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Bill. I really appreciate your having me on the show.
You're listening to Only a Game. On Tuesday, ESPN will celebrate its 30th anniversary, but Only a Game media analyst John Carroll says the once brash upstart has changed over the past three decades to the point where rooting for the network is like rooting for U.S. Steel used to be.
For much of its 30 years, ESPN was sort of the class clown of the sports world. Smart-alecky and sarcastic, the all-sports cable outfit presented itself as the perfect antidote to the ponderous, self-important broadcast networks. From its first cable cast in September of 1979, ESPN promised a different kind of sports coverage.
Welcome, everyone, to the ESPN Sports Center. From this very desk, in the coming weeks and months, we'll be filling you in on the pulse of sporting activity, not only around the country, but around the world as well. If it takes an interview, we'll do it. If it takes play-by-play, we'll do it. If it takes commentary, we'll do that too.
In fact, the guys at ESPN, and for a long time it was virtually all guys at ESPN, did a lot of commentary, the snarkier the better. But how the mighty funny have fallen since the Walt Disney Company acquired ESPN in 1995. Before long, you couldn't spit without hitting an ESPN offshoot. From ESPN2, to ESPN News, to ESPN Classic, to ESPN HD, to ESPN.com, to ESPN the Magazine, to ESPN the Dessert Topping. Just kidding about that last one, but you never know. What critics know is that ESPN is now officially same as the old boss. Naples, Florida news columnist David Moulton recently wrote, 30 years later, ESPN has become Cronmart, the industry power of Walter Cronkite with the business dominance and impact of Walmart. Last month, a college football blogger labeled ESPN Big Brother, while everyone criticizes the Sportsnet for being a self-propelled promotion machine that has gone MTV, in the words of one sports fanatic who happens to be my brother. Sorry, Bobby, the corn is off the cob in that department. After 30 years, everybody knows you can't stop ESPN. You can only hope to contain it.
John Carroll is a media analyst for Only a Game and a mass communication professor at Boston University. You can read his blog at campaignoutsider.com. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On Sunday, Guadalajara was no place for people who don't appreciate mariachi bands. 549 mariachi musicians gathered in the Mexican City, and Stuart Claxton, a representative of the Guinness Book of World Records, duly certified there was no evidence of a larger gathering of mariachi musicians, although a couple of years ago, 520 of them did find themselves in the same plaza at the same time in San Antonio. The mariachis in Guadalajara surprised everybody by performing a piece of music called Guadalajara. They followed up that piece with El Cielito Lindo, which is Spanish for the Cielito Lindo. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, getting ready for a World Series during sweater weather. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL regular season begins on Thursday with the defending champion Pittsburgh Steelers against the Tennessee Titans. So, should we all start getting ready for songs about the Steelers' seventh title?
I do not believe so. I think that they have a fragile quarterback who is enormously vital to what they do. And I think that their still young, relatively inexperienced head coach is going to take a step back this year. So, no, I don't think the Steelers will win the title. I think it is more likely that the team up here will.
As the NFL prepares for action that counts as opposed to exhibition games, the Players Association has become the target of a federal investigation. Why is that?
Because, and we are going to discover as we go along through life, that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell is really going to be a blight on the game in a lot of ways. The feds are investigating whether or not the union leaders and NFL officials were colluding by holding secret meetings to discuss labor talks. They have a labor Armageddon coming up in a couple of years. this is kind of an interesting story because, you know, the NFL Players Association has been accused through various presidents of being a puppet union for management. If the NFL is now trying to keep that secret, that horse is out of the barn 20 years ago, I think Roger Goodell is going to turn out to be a guy we have to keep our eye on.
Charlie, here's a lesson in recession economics. When it's likely that 20% of your games will be blacked out in local television markets because people can't afford to buy tickets for them, is it time to consider relaxing your blackout policy?
Ah, another story in which I can mention that Roger Goodell is going to be a person we have to keep our eye on. Yes, very much so, in fact, and the blackout should be relaxed. There should be some notice taken of the fact that we are in an economic recession. And Roger Goodell, whose league has had the benefit of too many doubts in regards to its broadcast policies and its relationship to various governmental entities, should suck it up and relax the blackout rule.
Most boosters of college football teams express their discontent by threatening to withhold their donations until the team gets better or by calling the university president directly, but that's apparently not the way it works in South Bend, Indiana.
Notre Dame, let us be clear, Notre Dame is a wonderful institution. It's produced many fine citizens. When it comes to football, it is completely out of its mind. And most notably, its alumni are completely out of their minds. And most especially notably, the football alumni are out of their mind. They have put up a billboard across from the campus that reads, "Best wishes to Charlie Weiss in the fifth year of his college coaching internship. All you have to do, Charlie, is win the national title this year, and I'll bet they take the billboard down. Short of that, you're dead."
How do you feel about the possibility of being represented in the U.S. Senate by the Honorable Mr. Curt Schilling, independent Massachusetts?
Independent my eye, number one. He's a Republican. He's always been a Republican. I will bet.
Says he's an independent.
Well, he may say he's an independent.
Says
he can say he's an airplane pilot, but I'm not getting him on board. Look, he's not going to run. There's two reasons why he's not going to run. Number one, he might lose. Number two, he'll probably lose. And actually, no, I just thought of a third one. With Martha Coakley, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, running, he'll lose to a girl. If you think Curt Schilling wants any part of losing this campaign, you're out of your mind. I'm willing to bet that he will still be, quote-unquote, mulling over his participation when they're counting the votes in January.
Charlie, 2 weeks ago, I watched in person as New York Sky Blue FC beat the Los Angeles Soul for the Women's Pro Soccer Championship. During the regular season, the champions fired one head coach, saw his replacement resign, and were eventually led by player coach Christy Rampone. Has any other team experiencing three different managers in a season ever won a championship?
First of all, you'll have to forgive me. All of that escaped my attention.
I'm not surprised.
It's hard for you to believe.
Still, I wish you to comment on it.
I don't think there's a precedent, especially the player coach thing.
Isn't that great?
Because hardly anybody has player coaches anymore. They used to be very common when I was a kid. They don't have them anymore.
The Vancouver Canucks have signed goalie Roberto Luongo to a 12-year contract. If he plays until that contract expires, Luongo will be 42 years old. Who does Vancouver think this guy is, Gump Worsley?
I don't know. They seem to think he's the bionic man. Hockey teams do this all the time. They get incredibly silly over goaltenders. It's a vital position. Nobody doubts that. It's very hard to play. A really good one can turn your franchise around. The cheapest sport in the world is willing to just shovel money at goaltenders. I'll never understand this.
Not so fortunate in hockey contract terms was Paul Kelly, who was fired this week from his position as head of the National Hockey League Players Association. I hasten to say that, unlike various others who have held that position, Mr. Kelly was not accused of stealing the players' money or tapping their phones. So I wonder why he was canned.
Well, it's very mysterious. He seems to have been accused of reading some sort of transcript of a private player's meeting. He's denied that. His predecessor in the job, of course, got fired because he was reading people's emails. So the NHLPA is pretty sensitive to this kind of stuff. But the really ironic thing is that when Mr. Kelly was the district attorney, he was the one who prosecuted Alan Eagleson, the first president of the NHL Players Association, who was a transcendent crook.
Charlie, I know of your affection for world records, and so I think I'll let you tell us all about the feat of Stuart Hefty, who showed impressive eye-hand coordination as well as intestinal fortitude during this particular accomplishment.
As well, for my money, into formidable intestines when you come right down to it. He's Corporal Hefty, by the way. He's in the RAF. Let's give him his due. He completed, now you're going to have to hang with me here for a minute, Bill, the world record for flying the most loop-the-loops while drinking a cup of tea.
Sports.
How they verified this, I have no idea. He did this as a benefit for charities that help wounded veterans in Britain. God love him for it. I mean, is there also, like, a world record for flying the most loop-de-loops while eating a, you know, joint of mutton or a pint of beer? I mean, what is the Brit? Is there an entire British section of the Guinness Book for doing loop-de-loops while eating and drinking your native beverage? Because I really don't want someone to try to set the German one.
And finally, Charlie, the good news for the Atlanta Dream is that they may be so much better than they were in 2008 that they will make the WNBA playoffs this time around. Now, if you would, please tell Dream fans the bad news.
You don't...
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood?
Not them.
In your neighborhood.
Not them.
In your neighborhood.
You don't mess with Elmo. There's a scheduling conflict. Sesame Street's coming to town, and the Dream is hitting the road. Probably, I would think, to one of the college basketball arenas, probably Georgia Tech.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time. And let it be known that Sesame Street music doesn't throw him even for a moment. Thank you, Charlie.
This issue of Only a Game has been brought to you by the word sports.
Can you tell me?
Several weeks ago, Charlie Pierce and I discussed briefly the Russian national soccer team's strategy for avoiding the flu when they visited Wales. They intended to drink Welsh whiskey, with which Charlie and I were unfamiliar. Pursuant to that exchange of remarks, Jeffrey Richards, who hears Only a Game on KIOS in Omaha, wrote to say that Welsh whiskey is very good. I thought you'd like to know. Regarding the conversation that the incredibly versatile reporter, producer, guest host Karen Given had 2 weeks ago with Jeffrey Marks, the author of The Long Snapper, and Brian Kinchin, the long snapper himself, John Wild, who hears the program on WEPR in Greenville, South Carolina, wrote, "I have no doubt that God keeps his eye on the sparrow, but I doubt that he or she cares whether long snaps are accurate. Seriously, how much can religion be trivialized in this country?" Responding to the same conversation, John Ranta, who listens to the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, wrote, "I had to check my radio twice this morning to see if somehow Only a Game had been switched to the 700 Club. Please stop providing a platform for evangelists." Jim McKinstra, who hears the program on WNIJ in DeKalb, Illinois, was also moved to write by the show from which I was absent. "How may I contact Karen Given to get an autographed picture of her?" he wrote. "Is she single?" Last week's Best Of show gave us an opportunity to rebroadcast the story about the very successful Trinity College men's and women's squash teams, which include players from more than a dozen different countries. Dr. David Warren, who hears Only a Game on WLRN in Miami, was not impressed. "American colleges should recruit American athletes," he wrote. "If we are going to make it possible for someone to attend our colleges for athletic reasons, let it be the rainbow child next door. What the Trinity coach teaches is that winning is what matters, even if one has to outsource our opportunities and degrees to do so." And finally, Minnesota Public Radio listener Andy Nichols emailed with this query about the show. "I was wondering where the name comes from," he wrote. "I have my own theory, but maybe I'm wrong. I looked around the site but couldn't find anything. If you could enlighten me as to where the name comes from, that would be great." It's a mystery to me, but if you can answer Andy's question, or even if you can't, you can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can also write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Brooms, musical instruments, and pets. These are just a few of the items fans are forbidden from bringing into Dodger Stadium. Also, leave your umbrellas, beach balls, and weapons at home if you want to go cheer on Dodger Blue. But during a recent visit to the stadium, Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder found out that management looks the other way when it comes to certain sharp, pointy objects. And he spins this yarn.
If there's one kind of joke that can really make you groan, it's a knitting joke.
Did you hear about the knitting pirate?
No, I didn't. I did not hear about the knitting pirate.
He knits with yarn. Badoom-chi.
But when you're on a bus stuck in traffic en route to a Dodgers game, you've got to stay entertained, even if the joke doesn't leave you in stitches. If knitting jokes aren't your idea of a good time, there's always needle trivia to keep your mind off the rush hour traffic.
Question number one. If you have a size 6mm needle, what would the U.S. size of that needle be?
This isn't how most people travel to Dodgers games, but then again, this chartered bus isn't full of typical baseball fans. For one thing, it originated at the knitting and crochet store, Unwind, in nearby Burbank. For another, everyone, well, almost everyone, is knitting. Then there's the female to male ratio. Tonight, the folks on this bus are taking part in Stitch and Pitch, a nationwide event wherein devotees of the needle arts attend baseball games to knit, crochet, embroider, anything you can do with some thread and a needle. According to Libby Butler Gluck, the publicist for the National Needle Arts Association, the idea first came about in 2005 when the Seattle Mariners front office invited crafters out to one of their games.
And it was just a very casual idea, and the first year they got 1,500 people, and they called it Stitch and Pitch.
A year later, the National Needle Arts Association adopted Stitch and Pitch. This year, 22 major league and 40 minor league teams host events. The thinking goes that baseball stadiums are the perfect venue for crafters. There are a lot of seats, they're well lit, and as Butler Gluck puts it,
it's rare that people invite knitters or crocheters out to an event. And so, you know, anytime there's an event for people who like to knit or crochet, it's like everyone comes out to the event.
On the way from the parking lot to Dodger Stadium, I speak with LA school teacher Rose Collier. She's new to knitting and tells me she likes it because of the camaraderie it engenders. In particular, so-called stitch and bitch sessions, where a handful of women sit around a table, stitch, and, well, complain.
The knitting creates a bond where you have no strangers. So you sit there and you share stories, you end up talking to each other, it's like old friends.
But stitch and pitch, that Collier raves, is stitch and bitch on acid.
When you go in there, you're going to see me about 200 to 300 other women.
Uh-huh.
And what they do is there's no barriers. You go over to anyone, they're open. Let me see what you're doing. How did you start that? Where did you get it? And you're just talking to everyone, and they're open.
Thank you. Peanuts, your peanuts. Nuts, your nuts.
Turns out it's a perfect night for Dodgers fans to do some stitching. The Astros score 4 runs in the first inning, and by the end of the third, they're up 7-1. This romp gives me plenty of time to chat with women like Jeannie Key. She's in the early stages of making a floppy sun hat and tells me that knitting at Dodger games isn't anything new to her. She did it for years in better seats than the nosebleeds we're in tonight.
And I still remember the guy not letting me through with my knitting bag because he thought it was dangerous.
But attitudes have changed, not only at Dodger Stadium, but at other major league venues as well. Again, Libby Butler Gluck.
Honestly, they thought we would bring like 10 or 20 people out. And we had some of our larger events, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people coming out to these events. And now we're in sort of our fourth year, and they are more than happy to have us back.
Attitudes about needle crafting have changed as well. Looking at the nearly 400 people filling Section 40, I see tattoos and 20-somethings, even a few men, like Edward Baum, a self-proclaimed perfectionist who's having issues with a practice piece.
Yeah, look at this. Look at that right there.
Oh, that's a hole.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Baum doesn't care much for baseball, but he thought it'd be fun to spend the night with his wife, Mindy, a competitive knitter. How'd Edward get hooked?
He was sort of getting into my yarn, and I was like, well,
what do you mean he was getting into your yarn?
Well, he was getting into how much space it took up.
So Baum has started digging into it. In return, he hopes Mindy will try his favorite pastime.
Well, she's promised at some point to learn to program computers, but we haven't actually made any progress.
By the bottom of the seventh, the Astros have the game all sewn up. Most fans turn their attention to a beach ball that's getting batted around, but not the Stitch and Pitch crew. They're hard at work on Afghan socks and scarves. Mary Jamora, however, has temporarily put her knitting on hold so she can focus her energy on the Dodgers and...
give them a lot of good thoughts so that they start scoring, and it's not working. So I'm going to take the knitting back out and do it again because it's just not working.
But even at the end of an uninspired Dodger showing, Jamora's friend, Kathy Fogle, manages to find a silver lining.
I'm finishing my sleeves and my sweater because there's not a whole lot going on the field, so I've been able to focus on that, so that's a positive thing.
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Los Angeles, California. I sink and I die if you want to destroy my sweater.
Only a Game is produced by Doug Tribou and Karen Given. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Special thanks this week to Brian at WQED in Pittsburgh and to Craig Anderson at Oregon State University. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Charlie Schroeder's Stitch and Pitch photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Stitch and Pitcher Emily, who has a quiz for us.
If you have a size 6-millimeter needle, what would the U.S. size of that needle be?
Ah, come on, that's an easy one. It's a size 10. Give me a real challenge here. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.